This is The Lack with Helen Rollins, Benjamin Studebaker, and Nina Power. Today, we're talking about the 1981 film Possession. Helen, kick us off.
Right. So I might not be my usual positive self today. We were just talking before we press record about, I mean, potentially I really do feel that that civilization is on its last legs. Obviously, you know, not, but very much feeling the bleakness of the world. And watching this film, which I very much liked. But it made me feel even bleaker than I already do feel about the state of European contemporary cinema. And I'll go on to that in a second. But after, we were also saying that I think many of us have had endless viruses to which we have not developed immunity because we've all been segregated for the last 2 years. So I'm coming off like 9 weeks of solid upper respiratory tract viruses. And it's funny because I'm like over it like now, but just sort of feeling really like pissy at everything. So I apologize. But on the, this is a big long preamble, and then I will get on to sort of like some so-called theory. But on the plus side, there was a video that was going around about a certain something happening in Canada, and it was set to a song. And the song really gave me great, it really moved me the other day in a way that it touched on. I think it's the type of song that corrals your anger into something potentially, you know, energizing and invigorating. So maybe we can talk about that later. We're going to do a B-side on various 2022 topics, including dating apps. So we'll get onto that. But anyway, so back to the film. Yes, I thought the film was fantastic. The kind of film I grew up on, the kind of film, you know, I would be aesthetically inclined to make. But it did really remind me of a question that is really to the fore of my mind that started as a little itch about 8 years ago and has gradually come to the fore of my mind and dominates my thinking these days, which is to do with the state of European film. And the question obviously is, could a film like Possession be made in Europe in 2022? And I think the answer is resoundingly no. And this is for very many reasons related to economic actions or inactions that have been taken or not taken in Europe over the last 20 years, related to capital mobility, related to the forgetting of very basic principles, market principles in relation to tech corporations, related to neo-colonialism that takes place on our own doorstep, related to the inaction of governments to act on behalf of people, forgetting, being caught up in sort of a Silicon Valley anarchic utopian ideological promise that this form of capitalism is somehow different to everything else. And the media in Europe has become an ideological wing for this. For many reasons. Firstly, because in America, you do still get high quality art house films being made, films that are desired to be viewed by many people. So this film, if you look at the number of votes on IMDb that this film has, or its score on, say, Letterboxd or something, Possession is a very, very popular film that ended up gaining cult status over the years. I think there are reasons for this, including the fact that it touches on a question of what it is to be human at a level that transcends language. And I think this film does it really, really well. I think it has an impenetrability that lends itself to a continued sort of like mulling over of the questions of the film in the viewer. And I think it has this lasting power because of it. I think it does art. And I could talk about that, but I kind of want to be on my soapbox about this, which maybe I've talked about a gazillion times in other episodes anyway. But in America, there's still a free market in the arts. Obviously, quote unquote, free market. you know, I'm not on the side of capital, but we have degrees of capital, degrees of denial of the dynamics of capital. In America, in the media industry, you have brute capitalism, you know, which, of course, is unfree in that always those who are on the side of surplus value are favored, and always the quote unquote art that gets made when it's tainted by capital is that which denies the true antagonisms related to that market, or which justifies the system at play. But there are degrees of denial. So the denial of a bare capitalist system is one degree of denial, which has, you know, all kinds of problems. But the degree of denial that takes place in a state-funded trickle-down model that has taken place in Europe, because in buying into Silicon Valley, quote-unquote, progressive, quote-unquote, you know, well, not quote-unquote, but utopian logic, state bodies that were set up to protect the film indigenous to a nation or a culture or, you know, a population, whatever its identity. As what I'm saying is, like, it's not to do with inherent identity, but representing the voices of the people within the area they happen to live. These organizations have bought into the lie of this new economic model, and because of various pressures, including capital mobility, ceded their power to corporations through tax breaks, through grants, through giving all the resources in the local area to massive media monopolies that have become monopolistic precisely because of the denial of the true dynamics of very basic principles of capitalism that apply just as much to these corporations as they have done to any form of capitalist mode of production, which have become monopolies so big that they are have more power than the quote-unquote democratically elected state officials who now serve as the whipping boys to these corporations. So in this trickle-down model, and this is something that is not even denied, the trickle-down model, tax breaks and grants and all the resources are given to these organizations, these streaming platforms, whatever, and they come in, say, from America and bring the American crew at a higher level in terms of the crew members and dominate the production scene in an area for a given amount of time, making other projects, for obvious reasons, very difficult to get off the ground. And at the same time, there is an ideological wing of these organizations, which is focused on a form of right-wing utopian, as I say, quote unquote, progressive, which is not progressive at all, ideology, which is to do with mystification and identitarianism. And there can be a sort of a release valve on this very small level of select ideological sort of dynamics, which are displayed in film. What has been denied are the very basics of art and of the market system. So A, what art is, what the standards of art are, and B, the very, very obvious dynamics that make up a market, and the denial of which makes an organization or a society right-wing and totalitarian. This is not just a question of resource extraction and the impossibility of smaller art house companies to develop work. You have a lot of art house distributors which distribute, we saw this film on one of these art house platforms online, old films and often films from America today, which still count as art house. But obviously there's very, very many different reasons why it's very impossible to compete against. I mean, I can give statistics, etc. What has been the dynamics that have taken place in Europe with this state-funded trickle-down economics. But also, when I mean, this is, you know, the basic point of Hegel in the Phenomenology of Spirit, where he looks at forms of human society in their different modes. Obviously, we live in a complex and contradictory universe, and as human-speaking subjects, we are undercut by contradiction at the level of subjectivity. And various orders of societies throughout the ages have tried to handle this antagonism in various ways, often in more and more and more repressed and convincingly, well, whole and complete ways, but totalitarian, because precisely the more they repress the antagonism, the more that antagonism has to be like sequestered out into something else. But in an in a society where antagonism is denied, certain things have to operate ideologically to sustain the smooth running of the system, lest those who are excluded completely overrun the system. So you have things like the militarized police force in America, which should be, you know, directed towards taking that which is owed from organizations which should be under the remit of the state, but have managed to, through ideology, convince us all that they are beyond that, and instead enact extreme militaristic and, fatal violence against poor people. So there's a certain level of, bullying and exclusion that must happen in a society that is completely, quote unquote, imbalanced. But the only balance that there would be is something that take, and I say quote unquote balance, that allows contradiction to sit within it. Is to exclude those that would point out these contradictions. And art itself is a human technology that helps us tarry with the complex and contradictory nature of human life itself. And this film, we can go on and talk about this in many ways, does this in many interesting ways. There is a contradiction in terms when one is creating art, when that art points to a truth of contradiction, that ideology that justifies the new nature of not only, you know, we're talking about the media industry, but industries at large. It's very, very dangerous. And so those works must be excluded, but it becomes more and more and more and more ridiculous to the extent where we live in a society where we have never had so many educated people. We have never had such an educated society, but we are spoken down to and provided either extremely dumbed down content that aggravates us, or highly ideological and patronizing content that in this sort of neo-religious way essentializes populations and teaches us a lesson in how we are supposed to morally act. And this is not the realm of art, that is the realm of propaganda, religious propaganda. So a film like Possession, if it were to be put forward for production in the kind of environment that we have in Europe at the moment, in 2022, I think it would be absolutely nowhere near the possibility of having, getting to production, unless it was made in a very, 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 zero budget way, but in which case you wouldn't be getting the film that, you know, that it results in. And then once it's made, you know, it might be a very, very good piece of work. In fact, there's so much fantastic work out there, but that will not get seen because, and this is a whole other question in terms of, making profit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something that is used in now that art has been completely capitalized upon, that, you know, there's this capitalist imperative to have a return. But of course, in a, you know, beyond the regular dynamics of capitalism market, where we have monopolies, state-funded monopolies, who are just gaining more and more and more and more power as unelected bodies over, you know, holding sway over those who are still quote-unquote democratically elected. I can't even remember the beginning of my point. Blah-dy, blah-dy, blah. I've talked about this so many times. I have left out masses of details. I apologize if this sounds kind of sharp. I have, you know, ways that would soften it in terms of the greater detail of the dynamics of this. And it's, again, this is absolutely nobody's fault. But yeah, it needs to be said. It needs to be said. And this is not just a problem in art, but I think it is particularly painful to see art being destroyed in this way, because art is one of the things that we have. And I think it's one of the most powerful tools that we have. And I'm going to cry as human beings. Sorry. Okay.
Helen, starting us off with a frustrated call to action.
But this is an excellent hysterical reaction to possession.
I know.
Frankly.
I know. Which, this is exactly what I was thinking. I was like, I have way too much of an intense reaction to this, even though it's not particularly like an enjoyable watch or whatever, but it's done something to me, that's for sure.
No, I mean, it's an incredible film in this way, psychoanalytically, right? I think, you know, it's, I mean, I have to say, I'm gonna take over from Helen for a bit. I think, no, I also want to start by talking about illness and the fact that me and lots of people around me are ill at the moment. And I do strongly, you know, I kind of look like a sort of medieval prostitute as usual, but I even more so than usual, like red cheeks and like, you know, pustules. And, you know, I had norovirus yesterday. Absolutely horrific thing if people have suffered from this brief but extremely violent illness, you know, kind of winter bug. Again, very appropriate for possession. It's also a kind of like takeover of the body, which you're no longer in control of. And I think these experiences are always, I don't know, useful in some ways to be reminded of in fact how vulnerable and prey to infection and takeover we are. And I think the last 2 years, you know, I did my best to try to go outside as much as I could, even when we weren't really allowed to. I did my best to try to keep in touch with people. I did everything I possibly could to stay healthy. I wasn't always successful. I did, you know, mess up a few times. I got a bit depressed. But I tried really hard not to kind of get ill, and it hasn't seemed to have made that much difference at the end of it. I still feel like, you know, insanely vulnerable to illness. And I can see a lot of people are as well. And I think the long-term, you know, destructive effects of lockdown, both mentally and physically, have to be, I don't know, confronted before we kind of go back to normal, if we do, or in fact, are we just going to run around sort of being really ill all the time? Anyway, it's a very complicated question, but obviously I've been critical of the lockdowns throughout, and now I'm even more critical from a virologist point of view. Not that I'm a virologist, but as if I were, I think it was a mistake not to let people be exposed to all of the normal things that we normally encounter on a daily basis. Anyway, this is a sort of oblique segue into possession. It's a very, very interesting film. It's kind of built in reputation since 1981. It's by a Polish director, Zulawski. Probably saying that wrong. I think I'm going to pick up on about two or three themes from the film. I think one of the most interesting things for me, almost psychoanalytically, is this kind of idea that desire is kind of made into a thing in this film. So we talk about desire as lack all the time, and obviously, Isabel Adjani, who's an incredible performer, puts in an incredible performance in this film as this kind of incredibly slender, frail. She almost, in a way, embodies lack and desire. And the less of her there is, the more she seems possessed, well, in multiple ways, right? And the question of where possession is located is also extremely interesting, important. Is it that she is possessed by some malign spirit? Is it that she's possessed by obsession? Is everybody possessed in a certain way by desires that can or can't be met? I think this kind of externalization of desire in this monstrous thing, right? Like this thing that becomes becomes, in the end, the husband she didn't want, right? Because the film begins with her wanting a divorce from the Sam Neill character. But in the end, this monster that she creates through her own madness and through her own, through the, I don't know, the violence of her own being, the kind of killings she engaged in. She has sex with this sort of tentacular thing, and she keeps saying when Sam Neill is there, almost, it's not quite ready. But she's kind of making love to her own desire, which has become a thing, is become into, made into this monstrous thing, which eventually then becomes her husband, which is the very thing she didn't want. But the doppelganger sort of becomes the ideal form. So it's this very, very complicated thing about what it is that we want. And if we are in a relationship with someone, this relation of the ideal version of them and the how that intersects with actually what can be really awful desires, like desires for other people or just violent feelings and all of the kind of disgusting aspects of human nature, all of which I think here are kind of reified, like they're made into things, like they're kind of to expose those things, not as ideas or as lack or as absence, but as kind of presence. And I wouldn't necessarily describe this as a kind of horror film. It's sort of partly horror. It's partly drama. It's partly romantic drama. It's partly even a kind of spy thriller. There's that he's a spy. There's the whole issue of surveillance. This is a film obviously set in West Germany. Nobody knows that the wall is going to fall at this point. The whole enclosed nature of Germany, the two parts of Germany, is very much a kind of implicit story in all of the graffiti, in the architecture. There's multiple scenes of the wall and surveillance, but it's not made explicit in the film, which I think is extremely clever. So it's also a film about the partition of Germany at a time before anybody knew that that would end. So it's also a film, I think, about being trapped, about being possessed by a political regime. It's an extremely claustrophobic film. The architecture is filmed in the most incredible ways. The way the camera zooms around rooms where people have meetings, the way it kind of zooms through buildings is absolutely extraordinary. So it's also a film about architecture. It's also a film about politics. It's a film about violence and hysteria. It's a film about doubles. Not only this kind of doppelganger, but then also she, the Isabella Gianni character, is also doubled in the teacher who has different coloured eyes, but is almost like the kind of polar opposite version. So instead of the kind of hysterical, self-harming, violent, desirous, bad wife, you know, the wife who cheats, who doesn't look after her kids, you know, in there is the good wife. There is the kind of the overly saintly teacher who's kind of perfect and devoted, you know, and that the uncanniness of this presentation of the fact that, if you like, we are all at least two people. And I don't mean in this multiple personality disordered way. I mean in the sense of we are in a sense integrated badly always in terms of our desires, in terms of how we choose to do the right thing or the wrong thing, whatever we mean by the right thing or the wrong thing, whether we're able to live up to our commitments or not. I mean, clearly to be married and to have a child is our commitments that we want people to uphold. We would want ourselves to uphold. But that doesn't mean that it's always easy. And I think the presence of the kind of sexualized, the kind of post hippie, the sort of German guy, what's his name, Heinrich, I think.
Yeah.
You know, with his shirt always open, sort of seven buttons down, and his kind of sensual, sort of you know, almost like Esalen, psychedelic kind of you know, let's be free, you know. Although he also lives with his mother in this very Oedipal way. I think the film is very, very, very powerful and successful because in a way it points in all of these different directions without in a way giving you a sort of solution. It's very, very enigmatic, even while it is very blatant and violent and aggressive. And I think a superficial reading of this film would focus on the violence and not on the subtlety. And also the fact that it kind of implicates us all, not only in terms of our let's say, our worst internal behaviours, which might be to do with how we behave in a relationship. And the director was making this film at the time of the breakup of his own marriage. And I think probably everyone has had an experience of almost feeling insane, having an argument with somebody that you love, where you end up in like hysterical modes of behaviour. And it seems so at odds with, let's say, a public facing persona, or how we would like to be seen by the world. And it's always the person who you're most intimate with who sees you at your worst, I suppose, or sometimes engages with you in these kind of arguments, which are in a way completely nonsensical, that are completely deranged. Because in a way, it's only with that kind of person that you can be that kind of person with, in all of its horror, I think. I suppose just this, what would it be like, I suppose, if we could turn all of our desire into a monster that stood over and against us and we might, you know, have sex with, and it might ultimately become the thing that we wanted all along, which was there at the beginning. Okay, we'll leave it there.
All right, it's my turn. So, in Possession, a marriage goes bad. Things escalate from there, to put it mildly. By the end of the film, just about everyone we meet is dead. The couple, played by Isabella Gianni and Sam Neill, seem to want to possess each other. Each finds a doppelganger of the other. Neil finds one in his son's teacher, while Johnny creates one somehow. The doppelgangers are totally servile and undemanding. They aren't real partners. They are mere extensions of the will of the two characters. When relationships break down badly, we tend to stop thinking of them as collective projects. The other person is failing to do and to be what we want, and we focus on their failure. The other person has been turned into an object. The object is broken, it is not performing properly, and it needs to be fixed or replaced. The person is the lost object, the object of desire. Nothing they do is good enough, because we have begun to demand the impossible. We want them to behave in a way they cannot behave, and we are often unwilling to put in the time or effort to build a situation which facilitates the behavior we seek. In this kind of situation, it's easy to project the qualities we aren't seeing in our partner onto some third party, hence the doppelgangers. Of course, if we leave our partners and begin dating these other people, we would eventually discover that they, too, cannot be what we want. We have invested too much into the idea of the partner. We expect too much. No one can do what we want, and we are only able to imagine otherwise because we don't really know these new people as well as we know our old ones. The drive to find the perfect version of the partner leads to a lot of violence in this film. I'm not sure I can make sense of all of it. There's an awful lot of violence. Certainly, jealousy plays a role in driving much of it, but there's also a lot of suicide. The collapse of a relationship often makes the world feel unlivable for people who depend on it, even when these people are not themselves parties to the relationship. There's also the curious case of Heinz Bennett's character, Heinrich. He's not a doppelganger, but he does begin seeing a Johnny's character romantically. Because he's not a doppelganger, he's unable to satisfy a Johnny, but his involvement is enough to earn the jealousy of Neil's character. He's a bit of a rebound guy. He is not satisfactory as a replacement, but he is a serviceable waypoint for a Johnny between Neil and Neil's doppelganger. At one point, Neil hires a private investigator to sort out what's going on. For some reason, both the investigator and the investigator's lover are killed. I'm not sure why. It seems a little excessive, but I might have missed something here. Film critics often treat this film as an allegory for the divorce of East and West Berlin, or East and West Germany more broadly. That got me thinking a bit about irredentism. Those who hope to reunify countries that have been split off often rely too much on the idea that the lost territory can be an extension of the existing territory. East Germany becomes an extension of West Germany, Northern Ireland becomes an extension of Ireland, and so on. Irredentists often seek reunification for the purposes of extending their own reach. They aren't looking to create something new that synthesizes disparate elements. After German reunification, East Germany was a problem to be managed. The goal has been to make East Germany into an extension of West Germany, politically and economically. In a way, the Irredentist imagines the lost region as if it were a doppelganger of itself, ready and waiting to be reintegrated. In truth, political unions are more complicated and require an awful lot of give and take, just like marriages. When Irredentists become aware of that, they often become angry with the regions they pine after. Reunification so easily turns into subjugation if the stronger party enters into reunification with excessive and unrealistic aspirations. It shouldn't surprise us that the two German states won by the Alternative for Deutschland are both in the East. I'm reminded of a piece recently written by Helen Thompson in which she compares the European Union with the Habsburg Empire. In a way, the European Union is a bit of a Habsburg Irredentist project. Like the Habsburg Empire, the European Union is nominally committed to including all its member states, but in practice it economically and politically privileges the Germans and those the Germans consider to be similar to themselves. Is there an element of irredentism to romantic relationships? We are trying to achieve unity with the other, but on terms which do not always acknowledge the ways in which the other cannot simply be an extension of ourselves. How far can I take this incredibly strained metaphor? If a Johnny and Neil's relationship is like the Habsburg Empire, then is a Johnny and Heinrich's relationship like Yugoslavia, a dissatisfying waypoint between the dissatisfying multinationalism of the Habsburg era and the delusional catharsis of having a series of tiny, independent Balkan states? Am I onto something here with this notion of relationship irredentism, or did my crazy train leave the station a long time ago?
No, I think you've got something going there. I mean, obviously, there's the thing about this one other person in a society that has been completely eroded. Like, all aspects of, like, everything sacred has been profaned. Did you guys watch the Tinder Swindler the other day? Interestingly, in a similar way to watching this, I had like such intense affect, almost inducing like a fucking panic attack, because I feel like it's about the women who were, you know, swindled by some catfish guy on Tinder. Long story, kind of insane, but basically they each took out like $250,000 on credit cards, you know, that kind of like level of insane, and this perpetual promise that this guy who's pretending to be a billionaire's son, you know, is always going to come, always going to be paid off, and that feeling of exploitation and perpetual waiting, breathless waiting. I mean, it's like that's the experience of being in debt. And we are all in debt to the other in this like horribly exploitative world. And all areas that, you know, as Marx says, everything sacred is profane, all, you know, sublime connections between human beings that are beyond the realms of quote unquote value, and value is generated by exploitation, have disappeared. And it's a horrible, like this thrust into this, it's like being thrust into the real with no protection, with no safety vest, with no fucking parachute. And, you know, it gets to a stage where you would think one can't take it anymore, but it is amazing in terms of the ideology of promise, what human beings can take if they believe that the promise is coming. But of course, if you understand the actual mechanism of capitalism, it doesn't fucking come. And even if it did come, we'd be melancholic because our desire would end. So, you know, great. Well done, everybody. We fucked ourselves. But the thing with the relationships is, yeah, of course, like now, you know, everything, you know, we don't have multi-generational families in the West. We don't have religious organizations. We don't have, you know, school is highly commoditized. You know, our rest is commoditized, our interactions on fucking social media, where we are generating value for tech billionaires every fucking minute that we spend on the fucking apps. Like, we labor always, and it is horrible. And the one little salve that we might have is, you know, a partner. Like, and it's too much. It's too much for an individual. And it has, I think, the anguish of finding the person who can save you from the absolute excessive, intolerable, illness-inducing, you know, we have illnesses of anxiety, disquiet, of metabolism, of stress. It's unbearable, and we seek one other that can save us. And the thing is, this is not a moralist question of like, oh, get over it, there's no one out there for you that can do everything. It's like, no, we're in a situation where the other has to, because otherwise you're fucking homeless. Like, it's unbelievable. And the funny thing is that, you know, the other thing in this film, well, there's two other things I just want to say, but these sequences with these sort of gross out sequences with sort of like, you know, bodily secretions and what have you, and even these sort of like almost campish overacting in a way. You know, you have the scene where Sam Neill goes on the alcohol binge for a few weeks, and he's sort of in his bed screaming like a child in anguish. But I honestly think it's horrible to watch, and it's something that we don't usually watch in the sort of the aesthetically created, curated world of a film that is slightly an alternative reality to reality. But I think it is something that is, and as I say, like, you know, maybe we can get a sense because it's unusual in a film, especially the kind of film that we'd watch today in the West. It's sort of overacting, but it's actually highly realistic. I'm sure after like a horrendous breakup or a horrendous situation, we've all been in that situation where we're kind of like, but also, you know, that the patheticness of, you know, that there's a section with Isabel Arjani in a subway, you know, secreting all kinds of things. We've all been in the bathroom puking. You know, we've all been with a virus, like endlessly, like secreting goo from ourselves. Like, we are these sort of vile, hapless creatures, you know. And we do. I mean, I kind of, there's a film I want to talk about next week to do with this question of denial, and why denial is so important to human beings, but also like the most toxic force in the universe. And obviously, you know, we have to get by. We can't just like let it all hang out. But there is something about this film that like, it really, really opens up the reality of being a human person beyond the sort of symbolic order, beyond the neurotic presentation in society. And it's sort of like, and in a way that like, I think horror films try to do this, but all fucking horror films now are like, listen to my feminist message. Like the female gaze in horror. And I'm like, I can't take being spoken to in this like midwit, identitarian, divisive, non-artistic, anti-Lacanian, claiming to be Lacanian because it's fucking film studies. I literally can't take it anymore. I can't do it.
Helen, I can't bear. you must watch only good films. There are lots and lots of very good films from the past and from other countries. This is very true.
But of course, I make films for a living, so yeah. I'm unavoidably confronted by this.
I know. But like, there is this intense resource, like, you know, and we don't yet have censorship of the, it would be impossible to censor all the films.
But this is the thing. But I do think this sort of nostalgia fest kind of, it's all right if it's in the past. And one of the ways in which good art is sort of kept from human viewing today is in the name of it being old fashioned. So it's sort of like, in the past there was truth and now there's just ideology. But it, like, you know, this thing of like every piece of art has to have a sort of, I'm fine with, like, art definitely says something. I think this film says a lot. It's, you know, extremely verbose in what it, you know, gives to us beyond the mere, you know, immediate visuals. But I'm so done with there being no subtext because the subtext is rendered text. I just can't.
Sure. I mean, I think there have been some decent films, horror films, for example, in recent years from a Lacanian point of view, like It Follows, for example. I thought wasn't it a very interesting film, you know, about desire, actually, in many ways, and about the kind of immateriality and the creepiness of desire and the sort of tainted nature of it. And I don't know, I mean, I think there are still a few good films being made that aren't just this literalist, you know, patronizing propaganda that you talk about, you know.
But I think it's really important.
I think it's really important for our own sanity as well to remember that it's not all doomed, you know. And watching films from the past, we're always watching them anew. Like, we're watching Possession from 1981 in 2020. Like, it tells us something about them, but it tells us something about us too. Like, it's, I don't know, not to be so, I don't know, like, effervescent or something inappropriately, but I I don't know. It's like the older I get, it's like revisiting things that like were written in the 15th century. And you're like, wow, you know, I was just teaching Augustine and to a lot of retired people on Monday, like what Augustine says about beauty. And I mean, it's just extraordinary. You can just read it. Like it's like it was written yesterday, you know, and you just think, oh, this is so fantastic. Like we can relate to somebody in like the 13th and 14th century. Like we understand what they're saying and why they're saying it. And it's like, we are that person. You know, we're not all Augustine, but you know what I mean? Like, we're all the kind of person who can comprehend Augustine.
Yeah, it's got to be frustrating to be Helen trying to make films in a particular national context where the government provides the bulk of the funding and the government is more interested in attracting Americans to come and film their projects in European settings than it is in funding European creators. And when it does fund European creators, it does it with an ideological agenda. That's got to be very frustrating. But I think that the point Nina's making is that through engagement with the past, we are always able to get out of our context that we're stuck in, no matter how miserable that context might be. And that always gives us hope that other contexts have existed. The universe has been capable of producing contexts in which good films have been made. But it might yet again.
This is true, but in order for that to happen, somebody has to be banging the drum for it, lest we fall into fucking darkness.
Yes.
I think the era of propaganda of a particular kind is coming to an end, right? I think people, it's boring, right? People don't want to be lectured to. People are clever. People are thoughtful. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, people are making, writing books and producing films and making TV stuff that is just patronizing and irrelevant to people's lives. And it's made by people who may or may not be well-meaning. Some of them probably are. Some of them definitely aren't. But it's a kind of trend and it will pass like everything else, you know.
But do you think it really works? Because I'm just seeing, like, for instance, I mean, I do agree that, like, the relevance of this ideological stuff is dying because it's untenable. And that song, we're not going to take it. We're not going to take it anymore. It's like, yes, we're not going to fucking take it anymore. Because this is, you know, I am on this podcast, but I know thousands, 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 millions of people who in whatever segment of society that they live in, whatever work, feel the same about, and as I say, this is just a dynamic that is not particular to a few people in the arts, but to the dynamics of our entire political economy. But do you, like, I mean, and I, as I say, I'm generally a positive person. I think this is coming from like 9 weeks of being ill. But like, it just concerns me that we're so in denial of what's really happening. And you look at the way that certain movements for the good are just cast as Nazi or whatever, so that no change is made. Like, I hope you're right. And I think you are right, but it...
Well, yeah. Part of what's going on here is, of course, the political economy affects how you feel about it. So if you've been interacting with the system in such a way that you're feeling stifled, which I think Helen definitely has in recent weeks, it feels really bleak. And conversely, you know, Nina has a book that has just come out, a really excellent and wonderful book that people should buy.
Yes, yeah.
Right? And so Nina's been going on all of these shows and being interviewed by people and having discussions where people get interested in Nina's ideas and listen to Nina's ideas. And so Nina's seeing the other side of it. She's seeing, you know, that there are people who are still interested in talking about this stuff. And Helen, you've been in a series of rooms with people who don't get it, with people who aren't helping you get where you want to go. And so the same situation looks very different depending on who you've been in rooms with lately.
But the thing is, okay, so it's interesting in terms of novel. So for instance, you know, a lot of the shows you've been on, you know, like the more sort of un-PC shows, right? So do you feel though that there has to be, there's sort of a like, we're only within this, the logic only operates within the parameters of the culture war. And so when a text or a work is presented, it has to be sort of marketed in this way or in that way. And it's sort of, this is the non, like, so within the arts world, it's sort of like, this is the self-congratulatory segment where it's neutral. And then this is the other side of the coin, rebel, whatever, when actually this first one, nobody is interested in.
Mm. I don't know. I mean, my experience so far of having this book out, and it only came out last week, by the way. So, and, you know, and there are kind of weird aspects to feeling like extremely overexposed, by the way. Like, I think partly feeling ill is also part of this. I woke up the other day and I felt slightly ego poisoned. Like, I felt like I was filled with spiders or something. You know, it's a bit weird. But let's take the positive aspects. I think what's, one of the things that's really interesting about it is that you can't actually predict people's response. Responses to what you write. It doesn't actually necessarily fall into easy culture war slots or anything like that. And to be honest, you know, my publisher is a very woke publisher. You know, it obviously publishes things like Jordan Peterson in Canada that make it a lot of money. But generally, we know that its staff tend towards being extremely woke, like all large institutions. It's extremely liberal and made up of lots of young millennial, you know, lit graduates and this kind of thing, right? So it's put out a book which is, you know, I think very reasonable and realistic and talks about real things that matter to real people. But it from a certain standpoint, it's controversial in that I talk about sexual difference being real and all of this kind of thing, which is obviously the case. But you know, obviously that in context, it's a statement somehow to even say that. But the reception, it's not kind of obvious. It's not, you know, like for example, the Spectator, who you'd think might be like quite pro it, were actually wrote like a really flimsy negative review of it. Other places, like, I don't know, have been like weirdly positive. Like, I had a really good interview with Brendan O'Neill from Spite, which was perhaps unfairly of me. Like, I was surprised at the level of, you know, intricacy and preparation and thoughtfulness that was present in that interview, because I had assumed that they wanted it to be more controversial and contrarian, and it wasn't. It was actually really much more deep and touching on lots of aspects of the books that other people hadn't picked up on, you know. So I don't know. It's a very complicated picture. Obviously, I'm extremely pleased that people are interested in the book. I think what I'm saying is on some level very, very straightforward. But for some reason, sometimes maybe things need restating. But I don't know. It's the pattern or the picture that's emerging to me is not a clear one vis-a-vis the culture war and the way that we normally understand things, maybe in a ourselves in a too black and white way. It's hard to explain, but
I mean, it's interesting because there's like what I would say. So to respond to what you're saying, Benjamin, I mean, in a way, I could not give a fuck about myself. I'm a very, very shy person. And I find, for instance, doing this, like, probably not good for my psychic situation, because I find I get interpersonal overload and what have you. What I will say is I possibly have too much of a belief in art to do anything. So I really do believe in the power of art, which potentially could be completely deluded. And so
no,
it does
you're
concern
not, you're,
me.
You're right. Yeah. Ellen, you're completely right. There's no life without art. Like,
no, there's
just
no
isn't.
Life without
there,
art. And,
there isn't.
And I just feel, what I feel is I feel like, again, this is in a way, I mean, this is using the example of film stuff. In terms of, I think when you're touching on Benjamin, in terms of like region or whatever, in terms of where I'm from, it is actually not to do with woke stuff, but to do with a different kind of identitarianism that is tied to a long history in this country. So it's nothing to do with woke stuff, but to do with something else. And this is proto-woke. I mean, this has been something that's been around for like decades longer than wokeness. But I do know that this is a tendency throughout Europe. But I sort of just feel so sorry for us as human beings. Because in a way, like, I think that all there is the here and now, right? Like, we exist in a series of perpetual nows. And I feel like life for so many people after the pandemic, in terms of what's happened to the economy, in terms of the way that young people are lumbered with so much debt. You know, when people talk about, like, the future of young people with debt, oh yes, the graduates are going to earn X amount of money and they'll earn a million more throughout their lifetimes. Those calculations don't apply anymore. And we're sort of going down. And I'm like, I do think it's urgent because I do think that art, A, good art is a sign that if art can occur, it's a sign that society is like not as toxic as it potentially could be, but also that dialectically it has an impact on the way we live our lives. So I just feel like, yes, okay, we can look to the past and stuff like that, but I really feel like people are, I sound like Greta Thunberg or something, but yeah, I feel like it's so bad. Like we're in such a bad situation. And maybe things are, you know, turning towards the good. But I know a lot of people that just can't take it anymore. But and as you say, like we see, all we get is, you know, truckers doing the work of everybody else. Like, so we have, you know, like the proletariat. We also have the cognitariat, who are just as precarious, but have a little bit of a sort of a cultural cloak and cannot give up on the promises of their childhood. But like, so all we get is sort of people who are so excluded as to be not even considered by, let's say, a certain class, educated class, to exist. And so they must be sort of fascists. But no, but like somebody has to say something has to be done. Somebody has to go to Apple headquarters and sequester tax. Like somebody has to have the political will. And I am not fucking interested in politics. I'm interested in art. So that's the little corner of the world that I feel like I can make. Not that art, again, it's not like art has to have a message or anything, but I think like art is a technology that does good. And I feel like if I can do anything, it's that. But like somebody has to have the fucking political will to do something. I just don't think we're automatically all going to, like, it's all going to come out in the wash and we'll all be fine. But I could be wrong.
Well, I think that in the big picture, there's a lot that's wrong in terms of political economy, in terms of our political system, and a lot of reason to think that we're not going to generate the political will to change the overall political economy. At the same time, I do think that there are still enclaves, places that people can go to find value still. It's getting harder for those enclaves to subsist. But I think that there are still some of them. And the unfortunate thing is if you get stuck in the wrong place at the wrong time in the wrong industry, it can be very hard to find one of those enclaves. There's an unevenness in the distribution of these places where you can go. And while there is lots of capital mobility, there isn't as much labor mobility. So you can get stuck in a place that doesn't give you access to those enclaves where they are. And I think that Helen's point that, you know, maybe those enclaves exist still in the United States to some degree, but maybe not as much in Europe. And Helen being stuck making films in Europe, that's difficult.
Yeah, but as I say, like I also don't think there's any promise in, for instance, like me, like I'm making films all the time, right? I have one that I've just finished. I'm just about to start another one. It's not really like about, oh, I can't. And we have these conversations all the time. All of my friends have the same conversation. So it's not like sort of about, you know, that level of frustration. I honestly think it's more of a kind of, I can't believe we've created the world we've created. And I think that, yeah, I mean, maybe it's a question of, we can do things in such, in these tiny enclaves, but it's like, there's a whole world out there, which is just abject.
Yeah. And I think that the difficult thing is, if you're in one of these enclaves, you forget that they're just enclaves and that most of the rest of it has gone to seed. If you're not in one of these enclaves, it feels as if these enclaves don't exist and they're impossible to get to. And the reality is, if you're lucky, then you become a rump professional. If you're lucky, you squeeze in the door and you get into one of these hidey holes that is still left. But most people won't be able to get in. And so on the one hand, we can say, and I think this is what a lot of millennials are saying, and this is in part why millennials, you know, as you were saying, Helen, don't let go of the dreams of their childhoods. These enclaves still exist, and you know some people who are in them, or you've heard of some people who are in them, and you think maybe you could still be in them. It would be unrealistic to say that nobody makes it. And yet we tend to either say, well, of course you can make it if you just try, or nobody can. And it's difficult, I think,
I don't think people are like, I think there is a question of that ideology of promise preventing political change, but I don't think it's anybody's responsibility to do political change. I think there's a question of like, yes, we can garner political will and something can happen politically. But I don't think it's as sort of individualist as like people desperately want this or desperate. I think that like there's a tragedy going on in terms of art where we're just losing a generation. And so it's not just like sort of like, oh, somebody, it's more like, because I know loads of people, for instance, who could say suck it up and make something that they know is going to make loads of money and blah, da, 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 because there's still various opportunities and do what they have to do. But I think that it's more that like the horror, a reality that is so far from truth. And that is terrible. And it's terrible. Yes, okay, we can read stuff from the past, but like, what about our era? Why can't we make art?
I it may be that there's sort of stuff going on in different places that we don't always know about. I mean, that people are making lots of different music we might not
this
come across,
true.
Or you know, I mean, and I think, I mean, at the risk of sounding like an absolutely naive humanist or something, I mean, I think there's sort of, there is kind of beauty, like people find beauty all over the place, like in their own lives, in their relationships, in nature, and you know, I mean, those things still exist. I mean, I know what you mean about the kind of erosion of these bonds and you know, the all of this kind of negative stuff, but it hasn't destroyed everything, if you see what I mean. Like, people have this resistance, actually, and they know when they're being lied to, and they know when stuff is bullshit, and they know when art is rubbish, you know, and they just won't watch it, and they won't be part of it. It's like, you know, and
I agree with you entirely, but this is where my worry is that we've created a world where we have this two-tier world where it's not a free market. Because as I say, like, none of this stuff gets watched. And yet it gets made because it is this ideological supplement, or because money isn't made in the same ways, but through capital mobility, tax evasion, and stock markets rather than products.
But isn't this just a reason to A, ignore all this crap, B, try to do things outside of those systems insofar as that's possible? And I do understand the difference between trying to make films, which require a lot of money and support, and, I don't know, writing poems on a Substack, right? They're two different things. I really, really understand that. And I know it's not easy, but there must be other ways. I mean, I don't know, like crypto money. Aren't there like crypto bros who would like give money for experimental films?
I have to say, as far as I know, certainly in my country, I'm the only person who does this. So this isn't a question of me being like, I want to make more stuff. As I say, like, I'm making stuff all the time. So this isn't about me. We made a film through exactly those means, crypto money, this year. So
right.
So this isn't a personal complaint.
Sure.
I understand, but I'm just saying,
like, for everybody who wants to think freely and to make art, it's mm-hmm. like, there are other ways of doing it. There have to be. Like, they almost will generate themselves, I think. And these other institutions will just become moribund, or they already are. Anyway, we're almost at the hour now. I wanted to play the Trucker song. I'm sorry, I made a noise earlier, but I think for Helen, can we dedicate the last 2 minutes or last minute of the show to the Trucker song? I'm going to try and play it off my computer, so let's see if this actually works. But let me know if you can hear it.
Let's get it going to your headphones, and then we're not going to...
We can add it in. We can add it in post.
Okay.
Yeah, that can be added in post. So okay. Assuming that it does get added in post, then we're at the hour. So we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you guys so much for listening and this heartfelt episode where we really talked about how the
I'm doing an AOC. I vote for £1 billion to Israel and then cry.
Yes, we've got a lot of pathos on this episode. And now we're going to go to a B-side. And the B-side is going to be about the state of dating apps. Oh, boy. So we're going to go do that right after this. So let's see how that goes. Come on over and hang out with us on the B-side. Thank you guys so much for listening. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.